From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Baer. Today on the show, we'll talk about a proposal in Detroit to issue bonds for blight removal.
It's no secret, Duggan has publicly said many times that he is obsessed, and that's his word, obsessed, with eradicating blight in the city of Detroit.
And we'll hear from the group behind a billboard campaign to draw attention to the ongoing issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women.
That complacency, that everything's okay, everything is fine in the suburbs when it's actually not.
And a theater in Flint takes on the trauma of George Floyd and the many men, women, boys, and girls who died just like him.
How do you keep waking up every day and going out and living your life when at any moment you could just not be here anymore?
Those conversations ahead on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, sitting in for April Baer. Today, a coalition of Native people from around Michigan is drawing attention to the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous people in places where Native issues might not be top of mind.
We just looked at, you know, the dynamics of the areas that we work in, and what does it look like? Are people paying attention to the issue? Is there Native erasure?
That's coming up later in the show, but first, among all the major items on your ballot this coming election, there are a few local proposals that could have a big impact on their communities. That includes Proposal N in Detroit. Sarah Swick is a reporter covering Detroit for Michigan Radio, and she joins us now. Sarah, welcome.
Hi, nice to be here.
So tell us what Prop N in Detroit is.
Well, Proposal N, N stands for neighborhoods, and it's a proposal put forth by Mayor Mike Duggan and his administration. It's no secret, Duggan has publicly said many times that he is obsessed, and that's his word, obsessed, with eradicating blight in the city of Detroit. And what he means when he says eradicating blight is basically ramping up demolitions so that all of the 20 and some thousand or more remaining vacant homes in the city are taken care of. So Proposal N is a proposal that suggests that the city borrow $250 million, issue $250 million in bonds. And they say they can do that without raising taxes because that's true, but it's also because Detroiters were scheduled to get a break. The city is going to retire some prior debt and it would have caused their tax rates to go down. But what Proposal N would do would be to keep millage rates the same and raise that $250 million or more if you with eventual interest and put that toward a program of demolitions and also preserving some of the city's vacant housing.
So how and why did this become an obsession, if you will, or even a political point that Mayor Duggan wanted to stress?
So in the Duggan administration, they've run this absolutely, since he took power in 2014, this absolutely massive demolition program where they've already taken down more than 20,000 of Detroit's vacant and abandoned buildings. And so far, what's allowed them to do that had been federal funding from that was originally slated to keep people in their homes to prevent foreclosures. The city actually got permission from the federal government to divert that into demolition. So they did that and took down all these homes. The thing is, well, two things. A, there's about that many more that they still need to take down or take care of in some way. And B, there's been a lot of clouds hanging over the city's demolition program. There were a couple people who pleaded guilty to basically bid rigging and sort of taking kickbacks. But sort of even more than that, there's just this lingering sense that the city, that there were issues with the demolition program. And the city proposes and says through Proposal N, they had been doing demolitions through the Detroit Land Bank Authority, but now they're saying, we're gonna bring it back under city control. We've taken care of all of these problems that, you know, sort of haunted the demolition program in the past. And sort of this time it's gonna be different, but there is still a lot of skepticism that remains about the demolition program. Now, in terms of the details, Proposal N sets it up so that instead of doing all demolitions as the city had initially planned, the Detroit City Council actually voted that down in a prior incarnation, which is how we came up with Proposal N, which proposes to demolish 8,000 or so vacant homes and then rehabilitate and restore about 8,000 more. This is Arthur Jemison. He's the head of Detroit's Housing and Revitalization Department.
If Proposal N is passed, the city, through the demolition department, will be able to go to the neighborhood and take down vacant and abandoned houses. They'll also be able to prepare for sale houses that can be preserved.
This Proposal N came packed with, it's different enough from the initial proposal that the Detroit City Council narrowly approved it, and now it's going to the ballot. There are some additional, I don't know if you could call them goodies or sort of incentives for folks where they're going to have this focus on rehabbing and rehabilitation instead of pure demolition. There's supposedly going to be programs where Detroiters can, in neighborhoods, can get their hands on homes and on properties. And there's also some measures in there that give preferences to Detroit-based contractors and companies that employ Detroiters. So it's slightly different from the initial, somewhat different from the initial proposal, but it's still basically all about taking care of blight.
So would this eliminate the city's land bank or just change the demolition program within it?
It does not eliminate the land bank. The land bank sort of acts as a repository for the all of the vacant and abandoned homes in the city, and they would still have certain duties they've taken on. It's just this would take the demolition program out of the land bank and take it back within the city, within city government.
Obviously, the mayor and some city council members are in favor of Proposal N. Who else is backing it?
Well, it's come actually with a pretty surprisingly prevalent and slick ad campaign pushing for it. Obviously, a lot of contractors are excited about the idea of it. And genuinely, a lot of people, some people who live in neighborhoods that are really impacted by blight and by abandoned homes, do want to see these homes taken down or taken care of or rehabilitated. But it's there, like I said, in terms of sort of trusting the city to do this, there are sort of some lingering doubts out there. And then there's sort of a more organized grassroots opposition that is sort of taken up arms against it as well.
What is the case being made about why these bonds should be issued?
The case being made is that it's, you know, this isn't technically a tax increase, that this is sort of a once in a lifetime opportunity to really get rid of Detroit's blight once and for all. I mean, you can certainly take issue with the argument that, you know, just by taking down homes, you're eliminating blight. But the way the city sees it is that this is a once in a lifetime opportunity to remake neighborhoods in Detroit and make them more livable, boost quality of life. And frankly, it's never really been cheaper to borrow than it is now, although Detroit, as a city that came out of bankruptcy just in a few years ago, won't get necessarily the greatest rates on the bond market, but it's still much better than it could be. So the argument is that, you know, they can really make quality of life better for people in the city's neighborhoods. And this is a once in a lifetime opportunity to do it.
Who's pushing back against it?
Well, sort of a variety of loosely organized grassroots groups. And as far as I can see, there's sort of three basic criticisms. The first one that I already mentioned is these ongoing issues that have plagued the demolition program and just sort of a lack of trust there, even though the city says they're taking it out of the land bank's hands and bringing it back within city government. But there have just been so many issues there that people may sort of balk at another expansion of the program. And then there's also the question of the thousands of people who lost homes to foreclosure, especially to tax foreclosure, are saying, you know, we really should be getting relief before we spend all these money on demolition. And some of these are homes that were lost to foreclosure, and that's one of the main drivers of blight. And then sort of on that third prong, which is related, some people just don't really see it as the way the city should be going about improving, you know, day-to-day life in the neighborhoods. This is Brandon Snyder. He's the executive director of a group called Detroit Action.
And they're asking for a $250 million bond that will put up about another $240 million in interest and actually not solve any of the conditions that led to blight.
So in Snyder's and some others' view, it's really sort of city policymaking and city decision-making that drove a lot of the blight in the first place. And this is basically now asking taxpayers to pick up the tab for it. And they don't really feel like that's right.
I also think it's important to note that the Detroit Free Press, their editorial board, actually came out against this proposal and said, quote, "We believe that removing dangerous dilapidated structures is vitally important, but any proposal to continue that work must include all the details Detroiters require to make a sound judgment about its prospects for success." Are there other details that Detroiters are missing in this proposal?
The proposal itself is fairly detailed, but what's sort of missing is a concreteness or a sense that in terms of, you know, the city is going to be compliant with, and, you know, remediation in terms of environmental hazards, things like lead and asbestos. There have been problems like that with that in past demolitions, and also that Detroiters are really going to get a good share of these jobs and contracts, and also the sense that will Detroiters really be able to participate in, you know, sort of getting some of these homes and buying properties. You know, I listened to a community meeting about Proposal N just the other day, and there were a ton of questions from folks saying things along the lines of, I've been trying to get this property on my block for years and years and years, and I just ran into roadblocks. What will Proposal N do to make this easier? And, you know, they give an answer to that, but there's no real guarantees in here that these things will necessarily be done in a way that some Detroiters feel that they should be, that sort of left them out of the process in the past. So we'll have to see whether basically this comes down to an issue of trust and how people are going to vote.
Sarah Swick is a reporter with Michigan Radio. Sarah, thanks so much.
No problem at all.
Sometimes what you really need to bring today's news into context is a little history. And sometimes it's coverage of a breaking story that helps you feel like you better understand. We at Stateside are revamping our daily podcast to help you make sense of it all. We've been retooling our daily podcast for must-listen conversations about what matters to Michigan. All the things that you love about the show in deep focus. The new and improved podcast launches on Monday, October 26th, and you're going to love it. If you're already subscribed, you don't have to do anything. And if you're not, just find us wherever you listen to podcasts. This is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Baer. Some of Michigan's theaters aren't just waiting to be able to bring you in-person performances again. In fact, a coalition of 23 companies, including several from Michigan, are leaning in to create a virtual festival of works specially commissioned for this moment. It's called The Breath Project. The Detroit Public Theater, Face Off Theater in Kalamazoo, Western Michigan University's Department of Theater, and the Flint Repertory Theater are all taking part in this weekend's virtual festival. April Baer recently spoke with two of the artists from Flint, David Guster and Harvey, about the pieces they created in response to the racial injustice against Black people. Here's their conversation.
David Guster and Harvey, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
Hello.
I wanted to find out what kinds of theater-making experiences you two have had since lockdown. Harvey, could you say a little bit about where and how or if you've been able to perform this year?
Yeah. At the very beginning of lockdown, I would do little Facebook Live things. And I have a one-woman show called Harvey's Cartoon Cabaret, where I sing songs from animated television shows for about an hour. And so I would do that every once in a while, and then lockdown kind of got to me a little bit, and I was like, I don't want to do anything at all. And then moving forward, I got to participate in the Breath Project and also Race, which is another project that is kind of on a national level by Sojourn Theater. And there's a bunch of different theaters and theater companies making like these, I'm calling them Zoom plays. It's devised theater. So me and a group of four strangers and our director got together on Zoom to create this 20-minute piece about what a leader looks like in America at this time. and what people in Detroit really want for a leader. And so that's a part of the Matrix Theater down in Detroit. And it's going to start showing later on this month.
Did I hear you say you're doing some work with Sojourn Theater based in Portland?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know them. I used to live in Portland. They're a fantastic company. They have a great process.
They have created this like theater piece called Race that has like expanded all over the nation to different theaters, and like many theaters all over the nation have their own race production. And so I'm a part of the one for Matrix Theater.
David Guster, tell me a little bit about performances and experiments that you've been involved with.
Yeah, so I actually, at the beginning of quarantine, was involved in a piece through the Empathy Project, which is a group out of New York. Since quarantine, they've been starting like these series. So series one, or volume one of their series through the Empathy Project, was focused on COVID-19. I wasn't involved in that one, but volume two was based on Black Lives Matter. And so I was involved in that production. They basically got a bunch of artists to submit works, and then they dispersed the works out to like different artists. So I got to do like a little short poem, just speaking about like the time. And then I'm also now working on a thing called Sits Probe Sessions that we're doing at U of M Flint. It's basically a showcase of plays written by Black playwrights. So we'll be doing Poof by Lynn Nottage, Black Top Sky by Christina Anderson, and we'll be doing, what is the last one? It's called Sunset Baby, actually, by Dominique Morceau. Mm. Yeah, so we're getting ready to film those next week, actually, and then they'll be available to the public.
It sounds like you've both had a real diversity of experiences. What have you learned about producing theater online?
Oh, I mean, the biggest thing is that, you know, it's just like live theater. You know, you run into problems like all the time, and it's just about like, you know, figuring them out pretty quickly, learning how to, you know, adjust, adapt, and just still stay motivated, you know, even though sometimes it can be like a little discouraging with all this like technology, trying to navigate all the technology.
Harvey, how about yourself? What are the lessons of 2020?
Yeah, I actually forgot that I did do an improv show. I do improv with Comedy Sports. It's a national thing, but I'm on the Detroit team, and I did an improv show with them. And when you do comedic improv and there's no one there to laugh at your jokes, you think it would be really awkward, but it's just a thing of being very confident in what you are doing and knowing that you're making the right decisions and you're making the right choices. So like nobody's there to laugh at the jokes or react, but it's like, I know I'm impacting them. Either they're saying something in the chat or it's like, I'm very confident in the thing that I've done. It really just makes you dig into your confidence because you don't get the instant gratification of an applause or a laugh.
It sounds like a perfect experience to get the courage of your convictions together.
Yes.
The Breath Project has asked all these different artists at all these different theaters to create original works that either touch on or are inspired by or somehow informed by the death of George Floyd and all of the moments that the community has been through in 2020 since then. And each piece is 8 minutes and 40 seconds long, which, as the world now knows, is the amount of time that George Floyd spent with an officer's knee on his neck. Harvey, your work is called Brianna's Prayer. Would you tell us about it?
Yeah. So Brianna's Prayer is, it puts the actor in the shoes of Breonna Taylor. So it's not me playing Breonna Taylor. It is me in the same predicament as Breonna Taylor, that I am going to die that night by the hands of police in my sleep. And so the piece, it's a monologue, and it's asking questions and thinking out loud. And if I knew I was going to die, what would I want to tell the world before that? It's like the last rallying cry before going into battle. because unfortunately, when you live in America as a Black person, every day is you going into battle and just being proud at the end of the day that you won.
I think what so many people found affecting in the extreme about Breonna Taylor's death was the fact that this happened in her own home, as you say, in her own bedroom. What kind of possibilities does that open up when you're setting a monologue there? What kind of feel does it establish for the audience's rapport with you?
The way that I set this up to be performed is in an actual bedroom rather than a set of a bedroom with a very small audience. The audience that I had was of 3 people when I performed it. And I ask questions to the audience, sort of breaking the fourth wall, but you can't break the fourth wall when everyone is inside all 4 walls together. There's no wall to break. So it's interesting to look someone in the eye and they're like 2 feet away from you and ask them a question that they're not supposed to answer. You just get like facial reactions. And so that really opened up a huge world of creative possibilities for me. I love doing immersive theater, but I've never done anything so small. Like I've definitely played to a small crowd, but not this small and this intimate and this heavy of a subject. So afterwards, it really like, it just breeds this great dialogue between myself and the audience on what it's like to witness such an injustice, like firsthand and 2 feet away.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Harvey. She's a theater artist in the Flint area. And we're also talking with David Guster. He is also a playwright and actor who is in the University of Michigan Flint Theater Department. They're taking part in the Breath Project, which is a collaborative festival by Black theater artists across the nation in reaction to the death of George Floyd. David, your project is called Nice to Meet You. Will you tell us the story behind it?
Yeah, so Nice to Meet You is actually my own personal story and experience with navigating being a Black student at a predominantly white institute. You know, I thought it was really interesting. I've always looked forward to going to U of M since I was a kid. And, you know, I got there and I just realized like it wasn't everything that I thought it was. You know, I realized there was a lot of things that I had to like work harder for. And I always felt like, you know, it was due to my skin color that I was like working harder than my peers sometimes. And so Nice to Meet You is actually a piece. It goes deeper into, you know, these like stereotypes that you might hear. You know, one example is like the kind of music that I listen to. I kind of have this thought process where it's like, you know, I know I want to say this answer, but I can feel, you know, the room kind of like nodding their heads in disapprovement of like, you know, my answer, assuming that because I listen to this kind of music that I also am interested in this and that. So Nice to Meet You is like this is who I am. And it is nice to meet you all.
I'm not going to ask you to reproduce the whole piece, but you talk about how this is a reaction to, you know, others' perceptions of you and others' assumptions about you, and it sounds like the sort of microaggressions that you deal with. How do you communicate that when you're communicating your side of the conversation? Could you give us an example from the play?
Yeah, so you know, one thing that I speak to is like, at the beginning, you know, I'm stating, hi, my name is David Guster. My favorite music to listen to is Drake. My favorite food is fried chicken. And, you know, I like to dance. And then it goes deeper into, you know, but if I say these things, I can feel all the white kids in my class mentally nod their heads like, okay, proceed. So I feel compelled to not say those things. I feel compelled to say that my favorite song is Johann Pachelbel's Canon in D, that my favorite food is a tall, rich glass of skim milk. But if I say these things, I feel like I'm coming off as pretentious for the white kids in my class and then too white for the Black kids in my class. So it's always this like debate going on in my head about like, do I, you know, want to say these things and deal with the microaggressions that come with them and the stereotypes that come with them? Or do I truly know that these are things I enjoy and I should be proud and, you know, stand up for the things that I like to do, regardless on like what people think?
Yeah. theater is very often the first and sometimes the fastest form of art to react to our times. And I just, you know, this work obviously is a product of the moment. Can you tell us about what, if any, conversations you've had this year that might have informed the writing that you did for this? Harvey, would you mind going first?
I have a very, it's not unique, but it's unique in my circles that my partner is a white man, and I'm very fortunate that my partner, he's very considerate and open and knowledgeable and is always educating himself on and asking how I'm doing with all of this stuff that's resurfacing this year when it comes to the movement for Black Lives. And so we have conversations all the time about it where it's just like, how do you keep waking up every day and going out and living your life when at any moment you could just not be here anymore? I say in the show, when you're Black in the United States, you kind of always know you're going to die, but you're just surprised when you don't. There's so many people that like Black people being murdered in America is the real pandemic. Like, we're in a pandemic, but Black people have been in a pandemic since the 1600s. And so it's like Botham Jean, he was killed in his apartment because the police officer that shot him thought that was her apartment. Is it a stupid reason? Yes. But that was the reasoning, quote unquote. But Breonna Taylor, there's no reasoning. There's nothing you can do or say that a person who is asleep was any sort of threat. And those other people were not a threat at all, but there's some reasoning that they can give, that white people can give to say that's why they deserve to be shot, because I was mistaken. But how can you be mistaken about a person who's asleep in their bed? Like, that thought is something that kept coming up in the conversations that I've been having. And thinking about that kids' prayer that they teach you, like when you're like a little kid, now I lay me down to sleep, I pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take. Breonna Taylor died before she wake. And so that was like the biggest inspiration for, or the biggest, yeah, inspiration for writing this. Like, that was like the first thing I wrote down when I wrote Breonna's prayer.
Well, David Guster, I wanted to ask you the same question. Are there conversations that you've had this year that informed what you ended up putting together for the project?
Yeah. So although this piece was written 2 years ago, it is still interesting how relevant it is, especially because I'm still in college. And so actually, it was probably about the middle of quarantine or lockdown. I started getting in contact with my former high school teachers, two teachers who have like changed, you know, my whole mindset on activism. They really have like encouraged activism. And they just are like, you know, two really powerful women that I know in my life. And so they actually got a group of us together to lead a protest in Flint. And it was really nice because it was focused on the youth and how severe it is that the youth is starting to understand like what's going on and how we can speak up for like what we believe in with all of this happening, you know, and how we can be a voice for the future.
I'd love to hear just what, if anything, it means to be able to produce this work in this cohort of artists at this moment.
I think that there was a brief moment where I had decided that I wanted to like stray away from this kind of work for a little bit, just because it seemed like these were like the only offers I was getting during this time. And I was like, oh, there's so much more I want to do, you know, so much more I want to show. But I think I am learning that, you know, this kind of work is really needed. And it's a great way for me to bring two of my passions, activism and theater, together and be able to share that like nationally with people who feel the same way all around the country.
Yeah, the same thing for me. When all this stuff was happening, I was like, I need to do like a creative outlet for it. And then anytime I tried to write something or anything. I just like felt bad. And I was like, this is making me sad. This is, I just wanted to like not do work about that. So when I was asked to create this piece for the Breath Project, I was like, okay. And it kind of just forced me to make something about this. And it's really the best thing I've ever created. I think it's amazing. I am very excited for the festival because I want to see what everybody could do in the 8 minutes and 46 seconds, because it's a long time, but it's also a short time. So I'm very happy that Breath Project exists so that people can see Black creators create things about their lives and about their experience. And it's from Black people by Black people and through the lens of Black eyes.
My guests today have been Harvey and David Guster. They're both theater artists from Flint, and they're taking part in Flint Repertory Theater's contributions to the Breath Project, which is a national festival of work created by Black artists, inspired by the Black Lives Matter movement and the death of George Floyd and all the other elements that have come together for a truly, truly harrowing year. David, Harvey, it's been very nice talking to you. I want to thank you both for your work and your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Bear. If you live in Grand Haven, you might have noticed a new billboard up in town this fall. It calls attention to missing and murdered Native people. The project sponsoring the billboard is the Native Justice Coalition, which serves all of the Native communities in our region. Its founder and executive director is Cecilia LaPointe. They spoke with April Bear recently.
Cecilia, welcome to Stateside. Do you want to introduce yourself further?
Yes. Menongichab, Boju, Nigigans Bapi, Indishnakaz, Ashishak Todam, Trikwidong, Ninawa Mashkizi B, Indojaba, Namanitagon Indao. I said my name is Little Laughing Otter. I'm Crane Clan. I come from the Kiwanabe Indian community and the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe, and I live in the land beneath the trees, otherwise known as Manistee.
As I mentioned, the coalition paid for the billboard that's up right now in Grand Haven, and it's going to be up there till October 25th, a few more days now. So this billboard was meant to raise awareness around missing and murdered women and girls and Two-Spirit people. Could you describe what the billboard looks like?
Yes. The billboard has an image of a woman, Native woman, when there's a red handprint on her face. And that is just to symbolize the issue. I know there's discussion on that, and it varies from the different tribes regarding what that represents. But with this specific issue, it represents MMIW. So, and it can also represent MMIWG2S, and there's other acronyms to describe the issue. The billboard is meant to draw attention. It says invisible no more, somebody's daughter. Some of them, they're different. The one in Grand Haven also has addressing the fact that, social distancing doesn't stop predators. And it also says that, this is how many, based on the report, the most recent report that we have, 5,712 Native women were reported murdered or missing in 2016. And now we've lost count. And we want people to understand what that means. It's not just, okay, this is an issue. I can't do anything about it. I'm powerless. I live in Grand Haven. I live in Holland. I live in Muskegon, and I'm going to and from work on US 31. No, there's something you can do. There's ways you can take action. When you see something, say something, And if someone's dealing with racism right in front of you that is Native, say in a grocery store, stand up and speak out against it. Don't let that person feel powerless. Support Native communities in exercising our treaty rights, because we still deal with a variety of issues like what the Mi'kmaq are dealing with out in Nova Scotia. And we have other issues always, unfortunately, taking place. So there is many ways that an individual can take action. And communities can take action as well. Just being aware that trafficking is occurring, just being aware that this isn't going away. And we're going to do what we can to take action as an organization and as a coalition in the Great Lakes.
Could you tell us a little bit about the conversation that you had with the position of this? You know, why Grand Haven? There have been billboards in other communities in the area over the past couple of years. But how did the conversation start about this particular location?
Yeah, so our work has grown, and actually the MMIW G2S program is just over a year old. We had actually launched this program in August of last year. And since his time, we've had 11 billboards in 9 different locations. And with that being said, we just looked at, you know, the dynamics of the areas that we work in, and what does it look like? Are people paying attention to the issue? Is there Native erasure? There most certainly is everywhere, whether you're in Detroit, Grand Rapids, you know, even our Native communities in Northern Michigan, where we do have more visibility, there is still erasure. So we picked Grand Haven just because of the dynamics of the area. And we looked at it as a place as well, that there are many of our Anishinaabe that live in the area. And in Grand Haven and Grand Haven, Spring Lake, and Muskegon, we actually have a larger population that is members of the Little River Band of Ottawa Indians community. So because we wanted to look and see, you know, what we can do, what is another way to kind of spark a conversation and challenge dynamics that exist in communities, that complacency, that everything's okay, everything is fine in the suburbs when it's actually not.
Yeah. Could you explain a little bit about why you founded the coalition and what convinced you about the need to do this work?
The coalition was founded out of a variety of things. If you look at it almost like as a pie chart, it wasn't just one thing. So we had an event in the Keweenaabe Indian community in 2015, Healing Stories and Racial Equity. We were a part of a statewide racial equity coalition. So we were the only project that took place in a Native community at the time. So the Keweenaabe Indian community is located in the western part of the Upper Peninsula. And we had an amazing event and a successful event. And after this event, another community member and I were like, wow, this was amazing. You know, it went by so fast. What are we going to do? And basically, with our conversations and moving forward, this is how the Native Justice Coalition was founded. But it was also founded because out of the struggle and out of things I've personally experienced, like racism in the workplace or racism in day-to-day life. But it's not just that. It's also the generational trauma, historical trauma, and the current traumas we face as Native people. So I take all of that and I've used it to grow the coalition.
Tell me a little bit about the coalition's goals.
Yes. So basically we are, you know, we work on Native-led social and racial justice. We're focused also primarily on our rural and remote communities. So we've worked in communities like the Keweenaabe Indian community, the Sault Ste. Marie tribe of Chippewa Indians. We've also worked in Hannahville Indian community and Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians. We also focus on harm reduction as a critical area. And we have a Two-Spirit program, which Two-Spirit is a pan-Native American term to describe LGBTQ+, as well as gender variance and gender expression. So there'd be different terms to describe this. Maybe these terms in our language, which here in the territory would be Anishinaabe Mo'en, they would describe someone who is different, but it might not necessarily be connected to lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, because these are pre-colonial terms. We also have the MMIW G2S program, which MMIW G2S stands for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women, Girls, and Two-Spirit. That focuses on addressing the issue that is basically one of the ways that genocide is continuing to harm our people and communities.
I mean, it sounds like it's certainly about missing and murdered women, girls, and Two-Spirit people, but it sounds like the coalition's work has come to be about a lot of other things, too.
Yeah, that's certainly true. We're a young organization. We're just rounding out year three. And as we move into year four, there's actually some new programs we're looking to launch and just growing our work. You know, of course, and I always say this, unfortunately, the need is huge. One of the things and how we look at it is that we're not actually here to educate the majority culture. We're the original people of, you know, this land. So as the originals, as Anishinaabe here in Anishinaabe Aki, you know, we look at it as we have to be strengthening and healing within the community, because there's always going to be those threats. I mean, you just had Trump here saying that we are basically wrong for trying to change Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day. There's nothing wrong about that. You know, there's nothing wrong with addressing racism or injustice, because what we deal with on a day-to-day basis, whether we live in Manistee, Sault Ste. Marie, Detroit, Grand Rapids, Keweenaw or Escanaba, we deal with racism on a day-to-day basis, whether you go to the grocery store, whether you're going to exercise your treaty rights. And so we just want to be there, and we will go the extra mile, literally down US 2 and I-75. We do not mind being there for the people. And we have a lot of wonderful people involved in our work. A lot of beauty in the community has come and is growing with this difficult work.
Yeah. If you're just joining us today, my guest is Cecilia Lapointe. She is co-founder and executive director of the Native Justice Coalition. It feels like the coalition has a subtle role to play here, in that, you know, you've talked about the fact that it's important not to invest too heavily in systems that are part of settler colonial infrastructure, but at the same time to inspire the kind of reflection that you're talking about, getting people who maybe haven't thought about the issue to invest in it, really. Is that part of the reason why you chose Grand Haven?
Yeah, definitely.
I wanted to take a minute to get your opinion on a piece of legislation that was passed this year. It was passed in the Senate at the direction of Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, and it's called Savannah's Act. It directs the Department of Justice to review and develop law enforcement and justice protocols to address missing and murdered Native people's cases. And I would stop short of calling 2020 a watershed year, but it does feel like it's been a while since something this sweeping that applies to both Native and non-Native government structures to act. Do you think that a bill like that represents some kind of real progress?
Most definitely. Yeah, and I think it's long overdue with what we need to address. There's been many people pushing for decades for the changes that we seek in our Native communities. And, you know, the level of sexual violence, the level of overall violence that Native women, girls, and Two-Spirits face is off the charts. And, you know, there's a quote that says one of three Native women will experience violence in their lifetime. But we've often in the community, we go, well, who are the other two? So there's a lot of conversation on what is this about? And some of the work that has been done by people, you know, in our Native communities is that this is a form of continuing colonization. It's a form of continuing genocide, that we are targeted based on our race. We're targeted based on our gender. And because we have things like the maze of injustice with the different laws, when we seek, you know, justice in this injustice, we don't get any sort of resolution.
I just wanted to add that bill was named in honor of Savannah LaFontaine Graywind, who was killed in 2017. How do you reset sort of your mind and your goals in a year like this one, where people have a lot of needs just related to their own lives and their own families, and at the same time, they do have a need to connect with their communities?
Yes. One of the things we've done is having virtual conversations, but we found, regardless of whether you're a baby boomer, Gen X, Gen Z, or a millennial, that the virtual conversations are a bit difficult. And with this work, the work that we do, we really need that community connection. So it's been difficult to not be able to meet in person, knowing that because of the pandemic, there are other struggles that have occurred as a result. So we're trying to be there for the community how we can, and just strategizing forward for 2021 and making sure that we can do what we've done in previous years, like the Healing Stories Program on Racial Justice, the conference, and just planning for maybe some other new possibilities to meet the needs that will unfortunately come out of this year.
Do you mind my asking what's getting you through right now?
I would say definitely the community. I just think of everyone's smiles, and I think of the strength of our people, what we've endured, what we continue to endure. I think about my family, my community, my relations, my parents, my sister and my brother and my family. In the Native community, our families are often not just, you know, who our extended relations are. It could be our friends. It could be, you know, someone, an elder really important in our life. And so, you know, making sure to stay in touch with those elders, which I do, making sure to stay in touch with community members that, you know, support and love this work. And that's the lifeline, you know. And because I'm Gen X, I actually really love talking on the phone. So I make sure, I do make sure to call, and I do make sure to talk and get, you know, the support and just kind of fostering and building, continuing to do the work behind the scenes. So when things are better and we can be more in community, that we're there, we're on the road, we're ready to go. And having these conversations with funders, you know, because it's actually 0.3% of 1% of philanthropy goes to Native-led groups working on our own issues. So we get the lowest funding out of all groups, and we, you know, experience all these various critical issues. Again, I want to emphasize, there is a lot of beauty in the community. There is wonderful and wonderful things happening. I can hardly keep up with the amount of awesome Native-owned businesses, and just staying away and not making so many purchases, although you would like to. Just the resilience, just to highlight the strength of our elders, you know, people's amazing journeys to healing, to sobriety, to education, to becoming, you know, a physicist or a lawyer. These are amazing things that, as someone who's Gen X, that, you know, a lot of the previous generations were not able to do. But we are about transforming and healing and empowering within, and we want to be there for our people. So we're going to continue to strategize and build and talk to funders and make sure we are supported and able to take the work to the next level in 2021 and beyond.
Before we wrap things up here, what would you say to people about why these issues are important and potentially healing for Native communities?
Yeah, I think it's important for people to understand that it's the work that we do is not just the work we're doing now. And how we often view things in the Native community is the work we're doing is, you know, there are many of our ancestors who did not have a voice. And that this work that we're doing, it gives their pain, their sorrow, their grief a voice. And so together, we actually heal with the ancestors, and our stories give their stories power.
Cecilia Lapointe is the founder and executive director of the Native Justice Coalition. Cecilia, it's great to hear from you. Keep safe, please. We wish you all the health that can be had in 2020.
Jimugach.
That's our show for today. I'm Laura Weber-Davis, in for April Baer. Our producers are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and our director is Mercedes Mejia. Interns are Catherine Newhan, Nell Ovitt, and Olive Scott. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Laura Weber Davis. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.